que interessante o tratamento de você.
É, é bom.
Geração.
I want to welcome all of you to the Henry E. and Nancy Horton Bartels World Affairs Lectureship. It is my pleasure on behalf of Cornell University to welcome as this year's Bartels World Affairs Fellow, the former president of Brazil, Fernando Henrique Cardoso. President Cardoso, thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule to join us at Cornell, and in particular, to give our students an opportunity, or I should say many opportunities today, to listen to you and to what you have to tell us about leadership in today's world. Since 1984, the Bartels Fellowship has brought prominent international leaders to Cornell with the aim of broadening students' understanding of the world. In addition to delivering a major public lecture, Bartels Fellows meet with students and faculty in a variety of settings, starting with breakfast, going through the morning, lunch, afternoon meetings as well. We put these visitors through their paces, and I'm delighted to say that President Cardoso has been wonderfully resilient in the midst of this demand. In addition, these visits are great opportunities for the Cornell community to learn about the world around them. Thanks to the generosity of Hank and Nancy Bartels, Cornell has welcomed many major figures over the years in this lectureship, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu, His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama, Joschka Fischer, the former German Minister for Foreign Affairs, and Louise Arbour, former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, as just four examples of the distinguished fellows we have had at Cornell. Hank and Nancy Bartels were unable to join us today, but I would like to recognize their generosity and their foresight by thanking them publicly for making this lectureship possible. I also wish to thank Professor Fred Logaville, Director of the Mario Einaudi Center for International Studies, which presents the Bartels World Affairs Fellowship Lecture each year. The 2010 Bartels Fellow began his career in academia, I'm happy to say, rose to prominence as an opponent of an authoritarian regime, and served two terms as president of Brazil, in which he brought a tremendous amount of positive change to that great country. He is today admired not only for what he accomplished as president, but also for his more recent efforts to further global justice. He's a native of Rio de Janeiro. He earned a doctorate in sociology at the University of Sao Paulo and published a number of books in his field. He was a fine scholar, but by the late 1960s, he was not only widely respected for his thinking on social change, international development, and governmental reform, but he was also increasingly involved in Brazilian struggles to achieve democracy and oppose authoritarian regimes. He was elected a senator in 1982 and again in 1986, and he helped found the Brazilian Social Democracy Party. Under President Itamar Franco, he served as Minister of Foreign Affairs and then as Minister of Finance. And in that role in 1993-94, he introduced a plan for ending hyperinflation, which proved highly successful. As president of Brazil from 1995 to 2003, he led a government that achieved major triumphs in the domains of health, education, agriculture, and economic reform. Just a couple of examples of the benefits of these reforms. A drop in infant mortality by 25%, a drop in AIDS deaths by two-thirds. Educational enrollment expanded significantly at every level, and the number of students entering college each year doubled. Nearly 600,000 landless citizens were able to settle on new homesteads, and the Cardoso administration tamed inflation, privatized state-owned companies, and removed many elements of federal government from the realm of political patronage, thus achieving a nearly 50% reduction in the cost of delivering social services. As striking as these accomplishments are, it is perhaps even more striking, given the history of Brazil, that President Cardoso's administration came to an end after the maximum two terms allowed by law, with the smooth transfer of power to his successor. The New York Times, on the occasion of his retirement from the presidency, called President Cardoso Brazil's great stabilizer, and a leader whose efforts at strengthening political institutions have culminated in a clean election. Since leaving the presidency, he has served as chair of the Club of Madrid, co-chair of the Inter-American Dialogue, and he is a member of the Clinton Global Initiative and the World Resources Institute. The UN Development Program named him the first recipient of its award for outstanding contribution to human development, and he also received the J. William Fulbright Prize for International Understanding. In 2006, he published a memoir written with Brian Winter titled The Accidental President of Brazil. He certainly doesn't seem the least bit accidental any longer. I look forward to his lecture. Please join me in giving him a rousing Cornell welcome. Thank you again.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much. Let's start by wishing Professor Hunter Rawlings for his kind words and tell you my gratitude to Cornell University and the Mario Rinaldi Center for International Studies for the opportunity to deliver today's Bartlett lecture. Let me add some two or three words about that. This is not the first time I came to Cornell. Long time ago, I was still very young, not very, but anyhow, in my late 30s, I came to Cornell because a former professor, a Cornell professor, named Kahl, K-A-H-L, wrote a book on Latin American sociology and have the generosity to include me among the three leaders of Latin American sociology, to my surprise, because I was not imagining such a, you know, maybe too precipitated recognizing of my possible developers in sociology. So I came to know the man who has had this generosity. Sometime later on, I came again in another capacity. I came I came to give a lecture here, and because a very good friend of mine was studying here, and he got his PhD in economics from Cornell. His name is José Serra, who is now governor of São Paulo and is running for the Brazilian presidency. So, and let me add that we have also two good friends who have been graduate from Cornell. One is now the head of the Brazilian National Development Bank, named Luciano Coutinho. The other one was my foreign minister, whose name is Celso Laffer, who also got a PhD from Cornell. So I have an immense gratitude to Cornell, because not just because of my knowledge of Cornell and by the fact that some friends of mine have been here, but because I had the opportunity to come here, and this is the third time, and now it's an honor to receive this invitation to deliver this lecture. And my subject will be not Brazil. You can ask me about Brazil if you want then. My subject will be crisis and change. You know, much has already been written and continues to be discussed about the global economic crisis of 2008. And it does confine myself to dealing with three key questions that may help us to look beyond the crisis itself and reflect about the connections between politics, economics, and culture in today's world. More between economics and culture than economic and politics. These questions are the following. Why the many warnings about the impending risk of a financial meltdown were not heeded? Why the catastrophe that so many feared did not materialize? What are the geopolitical and cultural consequences of the crisis? As you know, crises are not a surprise or an exception in the history of capitalism. They are a constituent part of its dynamic. Globalization is the contemporary form of capitalist expansion. If the technological revolution was its engine, financial capital was the driver of the process of wealth creation. Globalization is an old word. You know, the capitalist system always tend toward a globalization, first of all because of commerce, then because of export of industry. But now what we call globalization is a specific form of expansion in which the role played by the financial capital is crucial. So this is what we refer as globalization in nowadays. And at the heart of the crisis of 2009 is the disconnection between real assets, goods and productive bases, and financial assets, as in past crises was the same. The technological revolution enabled the system to engineer financial products of increasing complexity and obscurity. It also ensured the irresistible speed with which they spread to all countries, given the interconnectedness nature of the global economy. My sense is that warnings were not heeded because a certain degree of speculation and even of irrationality is intrinsic to the capitalist system. Speculation is a signal, a gamble. In the contemporary financial economy, much dependent on these gambles. In highly competitive systems, when some players start to win big with whatever product, competitor will feel compelled to invest on such product or to create a similar one. While all are winning, no matter how strong the warning signs, the gamblers by themselves will not stop. The casino goes on until the bubble bursts with a tremendous loss of wealth, with recession and unemployment. How can such a disastrous outcome be avoided? There are at least three possibilities. The first, of course, is regulation. Rules and mechanisms enforced by central banks and governments to create safeguards. For example, the limits of the lending leverage of a bank should not exceed a certain predetermined level. Also, all operations, including the so-called derivatives, should be accounted within the bank's balance sheet instead of hidden in off-balance accounts. This is the first possibility. The second possibility is to trust blindly in the self-correcting powers of the market and refrain from any regulation. In this case, bubbles are formed and the herd effect is played out to the full. When the system crashes, those who took risks and failed bear the cost. That is what happened in 1929. So compare what happened now with 1929, it was a real disaster because the burden of the crisis had been paid by those who inflicted into the casino game and also by those having not to do with that, but paid by losing jobs. Well, but there is a third alternative. The state intervenes ex post with all kinds of rescue packages. If it had intervened ex ante through regulation, the bubble might have been prevented. Once the crisis has contaminated the whole organism, state intervention can only be of a surgical nature. All toxic assets must be withdrawn from the system so that it can regenerate itself. Each one of these options has its costs. For the country as a whole, the surgical intervention is the costliest. Given the current level of economic and financial interconnection, the crash of an unregulated system can only be dealt with through massive handouts of money by government. If money in the required quantity is not available, it must be fabricated. You know that. The consequence will be borne by the economy as a whole. Rise of unemployment, low growth rates, public outcry by taxpayers. On the other hand, it is true that an effective regulatory system tends to somewhat curtail the pace of financial innovation and wealth generation. But the ultimate cost to society is much lower than the consequence of the failure to regulate. In a system with no regulation whatsoever, the cost is terribly high to those who fail, less so perhaps for the whole of society. Which of these is our current situation? In the United States and Europe, states that failed to prevent the bubble were forced to intervene after the crash in a drastic surgical way. It is interesting to note that the countries less affected by the crisis, like China, maybe India, and even Brazil, were those that had stronger regulatory systems. India's closed economy shielded it from the global tsunami. China's formidable internal dynamics allowed it to maintain very high rates of growth. Brazil's financial system was less impacted because it followed strictly the Basel rules on bank capital. This is an important point to remark. In our case, in the case of Brazil, we took a decision in 1995-96 to be very strict in regulating the banking system, following the international rules set by the International Bank of Settlements. So no one bank could make loans higher than 12 times the capital of the bank. In America, they did 50 times, 60 times. So they decided not to be in accordance with the Basel rules. The price was what is now occurring, a surgical intervention to give more money and to try to rescue banks almost failed. Well, as I said, the heart of capitalism is not the factory, it's the bank. Without the bank, the factory cannot operate. When fear replaced greed, credit froze, and the economy was on the brink of grinding to a halt. In some central economies, governments acted swiftly and decisively, such in France and Germany. The United States did something quite surprising. Faced with the risk of economic paralysis, the U.S. Central Bank became fiercely interventionist, but in a surgical rather than in a preventive way. The overall consequence is that most economies are today operating at low speed. Unemployment rates remain painfully high, both in the U.S. and Europe. Government's bailouts program represent a tremendous process of losses socialization. The cost of the crisis is being paid by the whole of society. And even in Brazil, where growth was resumed, there was a significant loss in terms of production and investment. In reaction to the imminent threat of a global meltdown, there was an unprecedented level of coordination among central banks, but each country remained the final arbiter. The U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, for all practical purpose, acted as the central bank of central banks in lending an enormous amount of money even to countries that had not asked for it. It happened in Brazil. We had enough reserves and did not ask for additional money, and yet it was put at our disposal by the Central Bank of the United States, the Federal Reserve. In the dark hours of the crisis, the G20 summit emerged as a strategic forum for global coordinated action. The International Monetary Fund, IMF, the International Monetary Fund, has been relegated to the margin by a capitalism that rejected regulation. A decision was quickly reached to strengthen its capacity to the immediate provision of additional resources. Well, this is a very unusual situation, because the idea was, let the system works, let the market without any regulation. And suddenly, when the crisis came, the basic instrument to regulate the market were limited. Basically, the IMF had no resource to face the crisis. So suddenly, the emergence of a political rescue network composed by the G20, that is to say, the wealthiest nations in the country, decide to take some measures. And in order to take measures, they ask again the IMF, and they gave to the IMF considerable amount of money to continue the process of rescuing different economies which were suffering tremendous pressure because of the financial crisis. Well, but the fact is that another issue that gained prominence was the discussion about the imbalances in the world system. Some countries accumulated high debts and others, like China, high levels of reserves. Increased pressure was applied over China to raise the value of its currency. China's reaction was to propose the creation of a global currency. At this point, it is of the utmost complexity. So far, nothing has happened. And we remain at that point. The Chinese said, well, to confront such a tremendous crisis, we need a kind of new currency composed by a basket of different currency. This is very important to say, but very, very difficult to implement. So the situation remains as it has been up to today. Others believed that the dollar would weaken and the euro would strengthen. Well, the dollar did weaken, but so did the euro. Confronted with the specific case of Greece, the IMF had the capacity to intervene, but the European Union was fearful of interference from outside the region. On the other hand, the European Central Bank lacks the IMF mandate and does not have the resources needed for large rescue operations. All these questions remain unsolved. It is not yet clear whether the IMF is the most appropriate global instrument to implement an effective bailout system. The European Union and the European Central Bank have a basic problem. Individual countries do not have an independent monetary policy, but they do have a fiscal policy. The consequence is that Brussels is unable to regulate the chaos deriving from the diversity of national fiscal policies. There is also a growing fear in Europe that the crisis may not be limited to Greece. Other countries, such as Spain, might also be affected. That is the situation. After the crisis, a surgical intervention. Let's try to do something. What to do? Let's give more strength to the IMF. But then, when the crisis continues, the crisis is still there, you have a problem in Europe. Greece. Well, the European Central Bank says, no, this is not an affair for the IMF. This is our affair. But the European Central Bank does not have the mandate to intervene, to rescue. On the other hand, there is a contradiction, because as far as you have in Europe, only one monetary policy dictated by the European Central Bank, we have several fiscal policies. Each country has the capacity to take decisions. It's true that in Europe, when they decide to unite, some limits have been imposed on the possibility of indebtedness by governments, no more than 3% of GDP. But the first one who decided not to comply with that were Germany and France. So now Germany and France don't have the moral possibility to say to Greece, please don't do that, because they did before. So we still are in the middle of that a kind of confusion, of meltdown. The conclusion at this point is that the crisis did not lead to profound changes in the global regulatory institutions. It produced a certain relative weakening of the Western economies and a strengthening of China, and also, to a lesser degree, India, Brazil, and others, emerging economies, or BRICS, as you usually label it. The major imbalance remained untouched. China continues to overexporting, accumulating reserves vis-a-vis the central economies. The crisis had a severe impact on several rising economies. That is the case of Mexico, that exported heavily to the United States and did not have the level of reserves of China, Brazil, and India. And Mexico was also victim of the concurrence made by China. So China is exporting direct to the United States instead of passing through the Mexican economy. And China took the advantage of Mexico's vulnerability to gain control over many of its manufacturers. Brazilian businessmen are afraid that the same may happen with them. They have been discussing with their American counterparts about a possible defensive move. If China does not change its policy, then a protective tariff would be imposed equivalent to what China is currently gaining thanks to its devaluated renminbi. This is a telling example of the risk of return to protectionism. In practice, these days, the American Congress, as well, not the Brazilian Congress, but Brazilian entrepreneurs, are trying to see if it's possible to increase tariffs to protect the domestic market from Chinese competition, using as an argument the fact that the Chinese are not devaluating their currency. So if this occurs, and this is a possibility, we will be back again to the old times of some kind of protectionism, which is something that should worry us. The global system, perceived before the crisis as undergoing a robust process of expansion, it has been perceived as that, has certainly suffered a major blow. And this shock cannot fail to produce geopolitical consequences. It is true that the states and societies have proved resilient to the crisis. There was no political fallout in terms of populism or extremism. Surprisingly, the predominant feeling has been a kind of general resignation to the state of things as they are. Even the altermondists, those who are against globalization, so to speak, in their denunciations of the evils of globalization, remain quite silent as the crisis unfolds. It is as given the lack of a viable alternative, the task at hand is to repair the current system, not to replace it with something else. But so far, the system has not been repaired, much less reformed. In open and competitive system, incumbents everywhere are having a hard time. Obama won the election as a reformer and now suffers the inevitable erosion of an incumbent. Poor Obama. Bad luck to be elected exactly in the middle of the crisis. Well, I know that because I suffered several crises. It's not easy. In Japan, the ruling Liberal Party was defeated. Change is now imminent in Britain. Maybe the Labour will be even capable to overcome, but it will be very difficult. And very likely in Spain, it depends on the other side. You know, elections always depend on the others. So I don't know if in Spain the Socialist Party will be replaced, but the risks to be replaced by the Popular Party. Well, and perhaps even in France next year, midterms election in France represent a kind of disaster to President Sarkozy. So it is irrelevant whether the challenge comes from the right or the left. There is hardly any ideology involved. It's a consequence of the crisis. So in some countries, when right is in power, it's time for left. When left is in power, it's time for right. The system remains open and competitive, but it is unlikely that newly elected governors will bring significant policy changes and will face newly political regimes in very important, very key nations across the globe. In closed systems, the channels for political protests are blocked. Ordinary people are paying the price of the crisis but cannot express their discontent. This may be the case of Russia. If the system was truly democratic, probably even in Russia, the government might have fallen. Well, so this is the situation. The crisis, the difficulty to deal with the crisis, some dreams in terms of let's restructure the global system, the failure in restructuring the global system, some attempts to remediate here and there, and some political consequence. The pace of growth is limited, is restricted. We are trying to recover, but we don't know yet if we will recover. And even countries that have been considered as successful economies, like Brazil, last year, I mean, to 2008, the rate of growth was 5. To 2009 was 0. In practice, was 0.0, negative. So it was a tremendous decay. So this is the situation, and we will face political, not turmoils in a strong sense, but political changes. In Spanish, we used to say earthquake when it's a real earthquake. When it's a small one, we say temblores. So the political system is now going to pass through temblores. Not necessarily a word cake, but some temblores. This leads me to the second part of my talk, a reflection about change in contemporary society. I will offer you a bold hypothesis. Given the apparent rigidity of society today, and perhaps because of that, change, when it comes, occurs in a quite unexpected way as a kind of short circuit. The short circuit may be contained in life goes on, as if nothing had happened, or the spark may ignite a fire that engulfs the whole system, revealing the extent to its structural degree of decay. Let me give you an example out of my personal experience. I was professor at Nanterre in Paris in the months leading to the student revolt of 1968. One of the students of my sociology course was Daniel Combandi, Daniel Le Rouge, the charismatic leader to be of the Parisian students, and he was a student of mine at that time in France. I'm not responsible for what occurred after. I gave course on Marx, Weber, Durkheim, very very abstract things. Not well, at the time, France seemed prosperous and happy. In March 68. One of the leading editorialists of Le Monde published a first-page article entitled La France s'ennuie, France is bored. Well, in Nanterre, in the periphery of Paris, I can tell you, boys and girls were not bored at all. Their demand was simple and direct: the right for female students to have access to the boys' dormitories. This was the spark that lighted the fire. Well, I was there at the time. I was just coming back from Chile. I was in exile in Chile and then in France. This was 68. In Latin America, Guevara all around, the Cuban Revolution, class struggle. This was Latin America. When I came to Nanterre, to my surprise, the main demand was, well, let the ladies enter into the men's dormitories. the contrary, let the men enter, because the ladies were allowed to enter, not the men, because it could be a... This was the debate in Nanterre. I remember one prominent Brazilian economist named Celso Furtado was also teaching in France, was also in exile. And we had once a week, we had a lunch with another friend, a sociologist, Brazilian. And one of these days, another Brazilian who had been minister, but very well, very badly informed about what was going on in France, came to have lunch with us and asked us, what has happened here? And Furtado, which is an eminent economist in Brazil and was professor at Yale, he said, oh, nothing. La France est toujours, n'a jamais été comme aujourd'hui. France never have been as in nowadays. Because in the past we had Louis XIV, and he was le roi soleil, the sun king. But he was not able to hang around Paris because he was all the time aggressed by people. And now De Gaulle is all around Paris and everybody applaud De Gaulle. Nothing. This was February 68. In May 68, Paris was burning with the barricades, so on and so forth. And the short circuit was produced by a demand by students. And why? Because the Minister of Education was trying to make a reform in France. And the most influential newspaper in France, Le Monde, was supporting the minister. So the newspaper was trying to get information from the students and to produce noise. And the students start producing noise. At one point in time, I was in a meeting with professors there, and one of my colleagues, professor of geography, a communist, said, I'm ashamed. I cannot invite my colleagues from Poland because there is a disorder in Nanterre. From my viewpoint, with my eyes, no disorder at all. Only some leaflets, you know, so asking for more freedom. So the the congregation is the name we used to say that's in France, the whole professorship, decide to close down the Nanterre in order to show that it would be impossible. They were against the educational reform, and they used the students as an excuse to produce, you know, a reaction. They said, let's close Nanterre. It's impossible. A disorder is to in a very high level here. What happened? These students start by protesting, by making demonstrations. They went to Paris. They went to the Sorbonne. The students from Sorbonne joined the students from Nanterre. Then they went to see the some workers which were making strikes. When the workers joined with the students, well, enormous noise produced. De Gaulle was forced to take an aircraft to go to Germany to ask for military support, and he came back to Paris and had some negotiation with the Communist Party to keep power. Otherwise, he would be defeated by students and workers' movement, starting with that small question, not that small, in Nanterre, maybe. So this is what I call a short circuit. Well, what did May in 68 achieve? Political power did not change hands. The structures of domination were not changed, but the mode of domination was irreversibly transformed. The events of May, les événements, as they were called, represented a major cultural shift. People's mindsets and lifestyles changed in a profound and lasting way. I don't want to give you too many additional examples because it's not necessary, but I can refer to what occurred when Gorbachev, being, you know, this powerful Secretary General of the Communist Party in 85 and President of Soviet Union, so on and so forth, Gorbachev decided to be more open because of technical questions and military questions, because of the incapacity of the Soviet regime to absorb the technological transformations provoked by the communications revolution in America and in Japan, by the computers, the small computers, so on and so forth. At one point, Gorbachev said, let's open the system. And what happened? The system was undermined from within. It was not a pressure from abroad, from internally. And the decision was taken by Gorbachev to start a process of redemocratization, with some publishing some one or two books about that. And this provoked an enormous transformation in Soviet Union. To some extent, what occurred also in China when the Tiananmen movement was not exactly the same, but provoked a transformation. There is a very good book by the then Prime Minister of China, Zhao something, who has been published just recently, whose title is "I Am a Prisoner of the State." It's very interesting to read what this man, who was one of the Prime Minister of China at the time, says about the event. It was a miscalculation about the force of the students and the decision taken by the old man in China to repress. Well, the repress was successful, but frozen the openness of the Chinese system. And this was provoked by a small movement. If the repression was not there, well, what would happen in China? I don't know. But probably a different path would be followed by the Chinese political system. To some extent, even here, with Obama, what occurred, let me tell you my personal sense. I was here at Brown University. I had a commitment there for in the last 5 years, so I came every year to stay for some time. And I was in October before the year of the primaries in the Democratic Party. And I had a meeting with Bill Clinton, and I was not able to leave. I had to leave to Brazil, not to New York. So I called him on the phone and said, I cannot go, but anyhow, I would like to tell you that to my sense, what is occurring is that Hillary is being supported by everyone. He said, well, not just not just there, not just in Brown, all across the United States. So I came back in February. This was November. I came back in February. Everyone was Obama. And why? Probably because of him. I attend the Democratic Party convention in 2004 when Obama was presenting Kerry, the first big speech he gave. Well, the man is really very impressive, you see. So it was because of that, because he symbolized to some extent, you know, a change in America. So this is the kind of of process that I think is necessary to call the attention for them. What I want to highlight with these examples is that in today's world, where the possibilities of change seem blocked by all kinds of rigidities, all of a sudden something happens and gives a jolt to a seemingly impregnable system. If the system breaks or just bends and adapts depend, of course, on its resiliency. Indeed, for a system to be at the same time open and resilient, it must have the capacity to absorb the eruption of the unexpected. I am persuaded, and that is a key point, that our theories of change must be reframed. Two trends render obsolete the concept of change as rupture, as a radical break commanded by a revolutionary class, the blurring of the concept of distinct social classes, and the growing fragmentation of identities and interests in contemporary societies. There are no more winter palaces to be seized. Power is scattered. Accordingly, change today occurs both in a more unexpected, in a more diffuse, imperceptible, and uncontrolled way. The revolutions that are reshaping our societies are not political. They are, to some extent, technological. That is the case with the new information technologies and with the biosciences. Both of these contemporary revolutions have a profound cultural impact. They reshape the way we live. In this sense, they go beyond the political revolutions of the past, whose major impact was on the structures of economic domination. They also have in common the fact that both disperse power and enhance the capacity of individuals to think, decide, and act by themselves. Open societies are less organized but more connected. Communication is increasingly participative, interactive, and collaborative. Life science and biomedicine are transforming our social landscape and enhancing ordinary people's capacity to control their lives. Technological innovation reshapes the mode of production and reframes human relations. Globalization strengthens the market. Freedom and choice strengthen society. What do these changes mean for the future of global democratic governance? Today, global problems that affect us all, from climate change and nuclear proliferation to epidemics, terrorism, international crime, can no longer be addressed only by states. They give rise to sustain new massive forms of social mobilization. This is a major shift that has gradually unfolded over the last two decades. Activists, thinkers, and scientists, businessmen, and spiritual leaders have been generating ideas and policy proposals on a wide variety of planetary issues. Media, public opinion, cities, all kinds of citizen coalitions and networks produce a steady flow of messages and arguments that influence the global public debate. In a conference 15 years ago in El Colegio de Mexico, I praised this informed and connected individual as the builders of a new common future. In that same lecture, I mentioned that we might be on the threshold of a new renaissance. The renaissance, as we know, had multiple philosophical and historical meanings. One of the most significant was the concept of man as a measure of all things. People of the renaissance may have felt a sense of insecurity and loss due to the collapse of the truth and hierarchies created by religion. But they also felt an exhilarating sense of confidence due to the capacity to control their own destiny. My sense was that the wealth being created by today's globalization might give birth to a flourishing of ideas similar to the creative explosion that signaled the end of the Middle Age in Europe. Making an analogy with Renaissance, making an analogy with the idea that man is the measure of all things, I suggested that we might be witnessing the emergence of humanity as subject. Confronted with global threats that affected everybody and empowered by the revolution in communication, this concept of humanity as a historical actor would represent what Marx, following Hegel, calls a concrete universal. This novel idea of humanity is not linked to any specific social class, nor is it being guided by any single utopian vision of the future. When Gorbachev made speeches in Soviet Union explaining why he decided to change the road, he said, well, it's no more possible confronting the nuclear threat. It's no more possible to think just in terms of nation or just in terms of class, because the nuclear threat affects all us. So we have to rethink in terms of humanity. This is very ironic, because this has been said by the leader of the Soviet bloc. The man was the head of the totalitarian empire, and he said, well, no more. We need to think in terms of people, in terms of humanity. This was a complete change in the way how people perceive what is important for the future. This novel idea of humanity is not linked, as I said, to any specific social class. Actually, the new concept is evolving as a process driven by many actors, speaking from different social and historical backgrounds. It is not organized around any specific overriding theme or cause, nor is it taking the shape of a set of rules as Kant would have envisioned. You know, Kant, in his dreams about the universal peace, said, well, the basis for universal peace would be a universal set of law. This is not the way we are approaching anymore. It unfolds through a collective, dispersed, fragmented process composed of an aggregate of themes and goals: human rights, environment protection, gender equality, peace and global justice, so on and so forth. Let us apply this analysis to one of the most challenging contemporary problems: the tension between universal human rights and the respect for cultural and religious diversity. We live in an increasingly multipolar and multicultural world. This acknowledgement of the constituent diversity of humankind is certainly one of the landmark events of our time. Human rights, as democracy, are a human invention. They're not a given, but a work in progress, an unfinished journey rooted in the history and culture of each society. We have had too many examples of disasters generated by intolerance, not praise the value of tolerance. However, we also have asked ourselves, what are the limits of tolerance? How far the tolerance of intolerance can go without negating itself? What are the precious core values that must be safeguarded in any situation? We are confronted with a paradox. How to ensure that respect for diversity does not lead to the uncritical acceptance, for instance, of religious fundamentalism? It is true that there are no straight answers to these questions, but it is also true that the international community has been forging, through dialogue and debate, a minimum set of common standards. I would say that the emerging consensus about what is clearly unacceptable encompasses, first, crimes against humanity like ethnic cleansing or the use of rape and famine as a weapon of war. Atrocities like the systematic use of torture against political opponents. The indiscriminate violence against the civilian population in situations of armed conflicts. The debate is still unfolding. What is new is that the voices influencing the process of deliberation are many and diverse. It is no longer up only to states and international organizations to set the standards. Global public opinion plays a critical role in the process, and global public opinion itself is an open, contested arena of debate where measures are freely argued. It is hard to imagine this process being reversed. It may suffer setbacks. Barriers may be erected here and there to try to block the flow of ideas. The aftershocks of the economic crisis may affect the trend toward increased openness and interaction in the global space, but it will not stop it. In the short term, fear and insecurity may lead to a revival of nationalism and populism, but I trust that the key drivers of this great process of transformation will prove stronger than the forces of regressions. Problems will continue to be global, and the actors engaged in the search for solutions will be many. Let us also not lose sight that over the last decades, the standards of living of hundreds of millions of people raised above poverty. Even inequality, this most intractable byproduct of capitalist development, reversed its long historical pattern and diminished in some countries. These positive trends will certainly pick up again with force once the turmoil generated by the crisis is overcome. That is why I think it is high time to deepen the discussion about the basic common values that define us all as human beings. What we do miss, and we will probably continue to miss, is the surge of a great art that was so characteristic of the Renaissance. Perhaps this is the price we have to pay for the demise of the utopias. I believe that this revitalization across the divides of culture and religion, of freedom and choice, the essential values of humanism, is a precious small utopia more than worthwhile pursuing. In counterpoint to the great utopias of the past, the affirmation of these values intrinsic to our common humanity is not an illusion. We no longer hope to their accomplishment in a nowhere land or in an indeterminate time in the future. Sharing and strengthening common human values are our endeavor here and now. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. I'd like to give you an opportunity now to ask a few questions. President Cardoso has been kind enough to say that he would take a few questions, and if you have one, please raise your hand and someone will come with a microphone to give you an opportunity to ask your question. So we have a question up here in the back. Could you come down to the microphone here?
There have been some really, really hard struggles involving demarcation of land. I'm sure you're aware of. How do you see that evolving? Are you optimistic that land demarcation will proceed, that UNAI will be able to move forward? And also, what can be done to rein in the violence that is prevalent, especially in states like Mato Grosso do Sul?
Well, I don't know. You are speaking about one of the most challenging questions for my country. I said to some students this morning that when I'm asked about the possibility of Brazil becoming one of the most influential and powerful economies in maybe power in the world, I say, well, probably yes, we have the possibilities to become, we are becoming a very strong economy. I have a different question to ask myself. Are we becoming a more decent society? And when I'm asking that, I have in mind exactly what you have in your mind. To what extent will we be, capable to stop violence, to stop, crime, to stop, abuses every kind of abuse. It's not simple. It's extremely difficult. It's a big country, uneven. In terms of geographically speaking, it's extremely difficult to get some points and to stop crime and violence. I myself, being president, you imagine the suffering of a person who has some is aware of what's going on. Give you another example: the burning of the Amazon forest. We have the possibility in government to know where is burning, but we don't have the capacity to go there and to stop burning, because it takes more time. It requires people, requires displacement, requires different aspects to stop. The same applies to the different other forms of violence. Even what is called as slave labor, which is maybe a strong way to say that it's over-exploitation of labor. We have programs. We are decreasing, diminishing the case in which the people has been exploited by the owners of the plantation or something like that. The same applies to violence against women. We create several specific parts of the police to deal with that, and we are asking the women to denounce the men, etc. And human rights violations is a constant battle. But anyhow, I think we are moving toward that. I must say that it's in the last, after the redemocratization, all these issues became very, very important and came to the agenda not of government, but of a society, as I said before. The important thing to change is not to change only government, it's to change people's mind and to voice and to organize and to utilize the instruments of connectedness to put more pressure on the decision making. So it's a process occurring across society. I think we are making progress with it, but it will be even necessary to have much more time and more effort.
Thank you. Yes, please. Please come down and ask a question.
Hello. Thank you for your time and coming to Cornell. I had a question specifically relating to your activities with the Club of Madrid. So my question is, in the past 10, 20 years, some countries have seen less of a role for elder statesmen. Some have seen more, especially in the international realm. So my question to you is, how do you see the role of elder statesmen like yourself and the Club of Madrid in foreign policy for the international realm in the 21st century?
Okay. Well, people like me, Club Madrid is here, first of all, a club composed by former democratic heads of states, presidents or heads of states. People like us, we don't have power. We can have some influence, moral influence. So we have to be very cautious in using our moral influence, not to disperse too much. Otherwise, the moral influence disappears. We have to look after some specific topics and to devote ourselves to these specific topics. Let me give you an example with another group, the so-called the elders. I belong to this group too. This is a small group of 11 or 12 people organized by President Mandela to take care of conflicts and to try to ease the peace processes or to put an end into conflicts. So, but looking at what's going on across globe, for us, this is composed by Jimmy Carter, Kofi Annan, Mandela, Archbishop Tutu, and some other people, and myself. So looking across the globe, my God, we have Myanmar, we have Sudan, we have Zimbabwe, we have the Middle East, we have Kenya, we have Haiti, I don't know what. So it's extremely difficult. So what are we doing? Is trying to select in where can we really have an action capable to make a difference. So what can be done by this kind of people is that to select some areas or some issues. For instance, the Club of Madrid was involved, when I was president of the club, At that time, we were involved in how to keep democracy in spite of terrorism. This was because of Spain, because of what occurred in Spain. So how to come to fight terrorism without undermining democracy? So we did several works on that, and we asked for a big meeting in Madrid, very influential on how to moderate the impulse by the democratic society toward a more strong reaction undermining democracy. Now the Club of Madrid is rather interested in environment. And up to today, the president is President Lagos from Chile. But this he will conclude his term this next month, and the next president will be a former prime minister from the Netherlands, Wim Kok. And I don't know what ideas has Wim Kok about what to do with the Club of Madrid. Lagos decided to support the negotiations in Copenhagen. So the lots of effort have been done to that. This is what we can do, you see, because we don't have power anymore. So we have to use our influence and try to use the public opinion to debate. That may be why I'm here and there, trying to convince people about some issues I have. But we don't have power anymore.
Yes, we have a question up here. Please. Yes, yes.
Mr. President, first of all, thank you very much for your talk at Cornell University. My name is Aini Yavaş. And right before your talk, I have a chance to read your life regarding your personal and professional life, education, elections, and your presidency thanks to Wikipedia. And I scanned all the papers, and as far as I can know you from Wikipedia. I see that as you have seen, you have one foot in the kitchen, especially in the kitchen of slavery. Sorry. I see that you are an accomplished professor and politician. And my question is that, what's your advice to the leaders of the future? Here, you know, we are all undergrads, grads, or postdocs. We are all students. I would like to ask your advice.
Oh, yeah.
On the one hand, we would like to be a professor in our science or field or subject. And in addition, if we dream about, as Martin Luther King, if we have dreams about our future, if you want to change the world, what's your advice to do our best, not only for professional or as you do sociology, but also in politics? What's your advice to the future of us? Thank you.
You know, it's very difficult to teach about the kind of issue, you see. It requires, you know, personal capabilities, experience. You have to try to here and there to become more capable to deal with different issues. You cannot properly teach how to become a leader, you see. What is important is to take into account examples from other leaders and to try to get in touch with young people. This is an effort done by the elders to have always to have contact with young people, to try to motivate them and to try to convince that some problem can be solved, even when they seem to be impossible to be solved, intractable. And to be a leader, to be a good leader, it always requires some courage, because you have to take decisions. And to take decisions means that you have to be in agreement with some people and against others. So if you don't have the capacity to take decisions, it's impossible to be a leader. And to be not just courageous, not in physical terms, but in moral terms, sometimes the leader has to be capable to take a decision alone. And even when the majority is against him, the leader is not the man who follows the majority. It's the man who creates a new wave, a new trend. So he has to have the capacity to be in isolation and to have the moral force, integrity, and to believe. It's impossible to be a leader without believing in something, to be convicted and to try to transmit by looking at the others that what you are saying, you believe in. So these are the main qualities. And I think that the young people can, to some extent, learn from the experience by others. See?
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Down here in the white shirt.
White shirt.
Hello. Mr. President, thank you for a wonderful lecture. My question has to do a little bit with South America. My question is, what is your opinion about what's happening in some countries in South America that seem to be regressing to populism? And what is the role of Brazil in everything that's happening? Yeah. I mean, specifically, yeah, to give an example, in Bolivia.
I understand. Well, to be precise. Well, you know, there is a kind of fashion out in saying that Latin, South America, at least, is moving toward populism or toward the left or populism. Something. Well, this is half a truth. It depends. You have different situations in South America. Take the country you mentioned, Bolivia. What happened in Bolivia? Bolivia has a majority of non-white people living there, indigenous people. And this majority has been all time put aside. I have been to Bolivia several times. I addressed to the Bolivian Congress. I was looking around. No one representative of the indigenous population when I was there. So at one point in time, the indigenous population decided to move. And the fact that one leader, which is Evo Morales, has some doubtful credentials is not enough to obscure the fact that the indigenous people are backing him because of that, because he's speaking on behalf of the indigenous, you see? So this is a consequence of an old-time domination without taking into account others than those in power. So that's a very profound difference when you compare what is happening in Bolivia and Paraguay. Paraguay is also a country in which the indigenous population is very, very big. But the Paraguayan leaders have to speak Guarani. They do speak Guarani to address to the population. So this is a symbol of some kind of integration of the nation, you see? So Paraguay is also poor. Paraguay has also had dictators, so on and so forth. But the form of how the society is evolving is different. If you look at Venezuela, it's quite different from that. They don't have any kind of indigenous problem. What they have is, again, Venezuela is a rich country because of oil. But rich for whom? For those in power and a small group of people. And, democracy was there for a long time. But those who were conducting democracy there have not been able or have not the possibility to look to the bottom of society. Corruption was very high in Venezuela still, but at the time was also very high. And rich country and poor people. This is a proper country for demagoguery. When a demagogue came and addressed to the masses by saying, "Look, you are poor and the country is rich. I am the man capable to redress the situation." It's easy to understand why the masses support this man. Then it will take time to change the situation. And in Venezuela, they have a kind of, and it's not exactly a road toward left, because it's a road toward a more statism, a more behind the capital system, the control by the state. The head of state has more power than anyone, and the state in general has power. The market system is still working, but under the specific conditions, you see? And some kind of what is called populism, that is to say, some efforts to redistribute money by cash transfer programs and by demagoguery too, by signals. So this is in that situation. If you look at other countries, look Uruguay. Now the president of Uruguay is a man who has been involved in guerrilla by himself. Was in prison for many years. He's an old man, as old as me. a little less, in fact. A little younger. And he's now the president. But Uruguay has very, very consolidated democratic institutions. It's a much more egalitarian society. So what is happening in Uruguay? Practically nothing in terms of, you know, of threat toward society or democracy or the economic system, nothing. It's just a trend, but within a frame, much more consolidated, and in a society which is much more egalitarian than Bolivia or Paraguay. Even if you take the case of Brazil, we are an even society, you see, with enormous amount of poor people. But the fact is that, at least after the redemocratization, every government is looking to the bottom of society and trying to do some hope. And social mobility is in continuity. So it is possible to those who have not yet reached a good standard of life to imagine the future for their children. And the schools are being, you know, offered to children. So this transformed the whole atmosphere in society, within society, in a positive way. The same occurred in Chile, you see. So in Latin America, there is a variety of situations. You cannot just take one label and to say, well, populist, statist, road toward the left, or authoritarian, I don't know what. It depends. You have to go more in depth to see what is occurring there.
Thank you.
So I want to thank all of you, and particularly President Cardoso, for spending an entire day at Cornell, beginning with breakfast this morning. And I think he has earned a much-deserved opportunity now to attend a reception to which I invite all of you as well. And you'll have an opportunity to talk with him again. And before saying our thanks one more time, I want to give him a small token of our appreciation, a little present from Cornell. In the proper red basket.
Yeah.
And also a certificate which reads, Cornell University names the Honorable Fernando Enrique Cardoso as this year's Henry E. and Nancy Horton Bartels World Affairs Fellow in recognition of his distinguished leadership in international affairs. Please join me in thanking him.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's really wonderful. Let's